Right, this is the final reflection session. And I just want to give you two very hopeful evaluations. The first evaluation is, has everyone gone home already? The answer is no. The second is, did anyone fall asleep this afternoon?
No, I didn't.
Well, that's a given, Morris. that is a given, Morris, but apart from that... That doesn't count.
You're an outlier.
Yeah, you...
You fell asleep at your wedding.
And more importantly, I didn't. But anyway, I think on those two evaluations, it does say something about the vibrancy of the entire seminar. On both afternoons, people did not fall asleep or leave. Fantastic. Anyway, we've got four very good speakers to wrap up with, and David and Mary have not spoken yet, so that's going to be a fascinating new input from new people. But I am going to start... I'm going to take John at the end because he did the groundbreaking paper. And I think, in a sense, it's a Cambridge thing, since Cambridge has hosted the entire event. It's entirely appropriate for John to take the last slot. So, Mary, are you okay about kicking off?
I am.
And if we can have a maximum of 10 minutes each, that would be great. Mary.
Okay, thank you very much. I have enjoyed myself thoroughly. It's been a wonderful opportunity to, sometimes share ideas, bounce ideas, and talk about deeply held passions with people who share those passions and who can extend and challenge what one thinks. So I've really enjoyed myself, and I think I speak for many people. I am going to, as you say, speak for 10 minutes. And one of the things that I found very interesting in the beginning is the extent to which the narrative that we have been debating is, in fact, a shared narrative. There's a great deal that we have in common. And I want to start with this magnificent work, I think, that John put together. And I want to, I think, on behalf of everyone, thank you for that. It was for me, so often I was just saying, yes, that's what I've always thought, or yes, I would have loved to have put it like that myself. And I have never put it often as well as you have. I started off thinking that I would like to summarize some of the key highlights of what you've done in that, but I'm not going to have enough time. So what I'm proposing is that I don't think I've heard anyone say anything that they disagree in that piece of work, which is an amazing synthesis of your life and your work in teacher education. So if I'm wrong, people must contest and say to me, no. We, in fact, don't agree with what John has said. But what I've seen is that, in fact, what we've been provided in what John kept calling the tome is, in fact, a consensus narrative. So thank you for that. The second thing is that with the OECD, I've thoroughly enjoyed the presentations. I think that there's been some amazing work. But one of the most important contributions in all of the work of the OECD is this consistent commitment to the fact that the teaching profession and its organization are at the center of an outstanding education system. That is also a consensus narrative. The third thing that I want to say is that there has been some very important discussion both yesterday and today for me, which looks at this idea that our friend from Poland started about teacher as citizen and subject. And the fact that I think that what I've heard as a consensus is that there's a moral purpose to education that goes beyond compliance, that the accountability paradigms are sometimes minimalist in the expectations of teachers, that in fact the teachers that we are in the language that we speak is a language of collective and proactive and internal commitment to the profession that's much more than these minimalist requirements that often are quite oppressive in the Q and A and E and that alphabet soup. There was all a very interesting discussion that wove its way through all of the contributions where we were asked questions about quality, about purpose, about equity, and about citizenship. And And I want to use something that Hugh McLean, who you know is the director of ESP, has written in the afterword to a wonderful online collection of writings looking at policy issues. And this second-to-last paragraph in that afterword has, for me, encapsulated many of my deep values about education, and I think it addresses the four questions that have been woven through yesterday and today, which is quality, purpose, equity, and citizenship. And he said that an educational system has a responsibility to deliver two essential things for a just society. The first is an improving quality of learning, and then he problematizes purpose, because it's not just quality measured by math scores or whatever else we wish to debate. It's not even about the ability to find a job. It involves something far more emancipatory in both a personal and a social sense. That's what we mean by quality. Second thing that he's argued is that it's a narrowing gap between students doing well and students doing badly. That, in fact, it's the inequities in education that have to be addressed if we're going to have a just society. And then the third thing, which I don't have time to look at in too much detail, but to achieve it, it requires both sound and tested and supported policy ideas, strong institutions. But I've underlined the third requirement, is that you need social mobilization to ensure fairness, accountability, and that promises are kept. So why are we here? Now, I might have got this wrong, but as a member of the preparatory committee, this is what I understood, is that the PISA results came out regularly, repeatedly, and the United States of America did not do very well. I understand that for maths, below average. Am I not correct? Something like 24 out of 36 or something? So the United States of America decided that it needs to bring together the 25 countries that have done particularly well, and they've done something which I believe is very important because it offers us challenges and opportunities, and it's contested terrain, and I want to talk about that contestation. So in 2011, they brought together 25 countries. They invited Education International. They recognized the role of unions, and I want to acknowledge that, but also say that there's battles ahead, and of course the OECD. That's where we come in, because then, in preparation for 2012, Education International has commissioned this magnificent paper. We've heard it's going to be published, it's going to be bound, it's going to be distributed. So the question for me is, what is the global significance? 25 top countries, many countries here could put up their hands, and we're not amongst the top 25, so why should we be here now? In fact, you, I think, provocatively said, well, what about the rest, you know? Are they in Education International or not? And the question is, what are the contexts in which the discourse of this American conference is going to impact on us? Because I believe it is. What's happening in the US, what happens in the UK, influences the education thinking in the world and filters through to countries that are not creating that discourse. So where we are is we're exactly there. We're in between the commissioning of a paper. We are having an opportunity to engage with wonderful people so that we can, I suppose, caucus with EI. Is that unfair? EI is being caucused before it goes to the summit. Because the opportunities and challenges that you will be engaging together with OEC, together with government that has invited you, will have international consequences in the way in which teachers' work is constructed, teachers' identity are constructed, and how that plays out in context of inequality. I'm changing it here and there, and sometimes I forget which one I've changed. There we are. So I think that there is a battle. I think just because unions have been invited doesn't necessarily mean that unions are recognized in the full force that we have argued in the last session. So now I'm going to go very quickly because I think I'm running out of time. There has to be a battle plan, and I think that the battle plan for the summit and for all of the work that follows is we've got to take back the reform agenda, and there's several things we've got to contest. First of all, that all of the language of the media, the language of government to a large extent in the dominant countries which determine the education agenda is that there's a preoccupation with economic purposes of education, the minimizing of social and political purposes. And all of that is about being in a competitive global environment and who comes first and who comes second, and isn't our national pride damaged by coming 34th? There's also something that we have to contest, which is the focus on teacher accountability rather than reciprocal accountability, and an increasing orientation to punitive consequences rather than supportive consequences. The die is cast, it's going in that direction. You see it in South Africa, you see it in the African continent, and the origins of it are in the battle you'll be facing. There's also, and all of the literature confirms this, there's this underestimating of the educational burden of the social economic context in which teachers teach. And this is a bit of a provocative thing to say, but the blaming of teachers is often in direct proportion to the political paralysis in relation to socioeconomic context. We don't know what to do with young people. We don't know what to do about unemployment. We don't know what to do with the general crisis in society. It must be the teacher's fault. And that is something that we also have to contest. So, the next point is that what we've seen, and I think the work of the OECD has been fantastic in terms of exploring what we mean by the knowledge base of teachers, but there's erosion of respect for the specialist based on the authority of teachers' knowledge, and teachers are reduced to being the provider of services to consumers, the clients, the parents. Let's evaluate how the teachers are doing, and a disrespect for, in fact, that knowledge base, which means that it becomes possible to capture the professional terrain. Everybody, because of the common sense of the residual expertise that remains after the 15,000 hours of imprinting, knows about education. You know just as much as teachers and the managerialism. So all of that has the consequence, and sometimes I feel it even may have the purpose of reducing the collective influence of teachers through their unions, reducing the influence of the profession and making it subject to ridicule. Now, all of that is bad for teachers, but the thing that makes me angriest is that, in fact, it's worse for education. Now, yesterday in the New York Times, there was an article. I don't know if anyone saw it. Yesterday, I'm nearly finished. Teachers' unions, it starts off, teachers' unions have often been an obstacle to efforts at school reforms. And then it goes on to say, but there is an exception. So in the public eye, all of this set of arguments which end up ridiculing teachers and saying they're an obstacle to reform. The reform language has been captured as if teachers are an obstacle, which means for us what we have to do is reclaim that space. Teachers collectively have to, first of all, I think, be the dominant voice leading public debates. Somebody once said to me, and I've always found it very interesting, if families and communities are subject to any debates about education, those debates come from politicians, not from educators. So they hear politicians talking about educators much more than they hear teachers. So we need to become much more the dominant voice. We've got to be doing the public work about increasing quality. We have to be seen as the spokespersons for reform. We have to be speaking about reducing inequality. We have to be seen to be saying, let's be fair, let's be accountable. And, of course, there's very good initiatives, NEA and others. The second thing that I think is important in terms of reclaiming the space is that there are new and innovative public education contexts. You'll notice that I've inserted the word public. Private is another matter. That's another contest. But there are possibilities in your scenarios for new spaces of innovation. And instead of being wedded to particular institutional forms, we have to be able to provide leadership in terms of what is the education best practice and wisdom. And the last one is about making alliances with social movements. Parents must become allies. Organizations that have the voice of communities in terms of whether it's quality or equity or relevance, care and support, inclusion, participation, are our best allies in terms of our commitments to education. And we need to make sure that we work with them so that we move away from that alienated position that's in the public discourse about teachers being an obstacle. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary, and thank you for the PowerPoints as well. David. David is representing OECD's final wrap-up. Dirk has given his apologies. He needs to get home. I just want to thank David for his consistent support on behalf of Cambridge and EI to this seminar. It goes a long way back, even before the formal constitution of the planning group, and he's been a consistent support, I think, Mary, and constantly inputting. Thank you, David. Anyway, 10 minutes.
Thank you very much. Let me echo that from our side. Our real pleasure to be able to be part of an event like this, which is working with Education International, working with all the different experts and stakeholders here, working with Cambridge University and the Centre for Leadership for Learning, which is very much near to our interests and professional focus in our work in the OECD on innovative learning environments. It strikes a very strong chord, and to work with the Open Society Foundations. So the partnership that this event represents is something that is, I think, has been a real pleasure to be part of. So I would like to say that very much so. Teachers and teaching has naturally been a very strong part of the OECD over the years. Dirk gave a brief overview. We did a lot of work in the 1970s. The 1980s, there was a big program on improving the international program for improving schools, ISIP, where teachers and teacher learning was very much a strong part of that. 1990s, I had the 1980s towards 1990, I had the pleasure of heading up a working party on the condition of teaching, which resulted in a publication called The Teacher Today. Of course, now it's not today, it's many, many years ago. But that's the part of the hard luck of working in this kind of way, that you look back and see a report like that. And of course, more recently, the kinds of focus that we've had through Teacher Matters, through TALIS, through the leadership work, which I think has been very important. And now, of course, all sorts of things coming through through PISA, through the political context that allows all sorts of questions to be asked now about teachers, that it's very helpful, I think, to be able to respond to that and to be part of it. A long-running aspect of the CERI program has been knowledge management, although knowledge management always strikes me as a somewhat prosaic title for a lot of rather interesting and exciting things, including the whole question about evidence, the whole question about developing that evidence and learning into forms and formats that can really be useful for different professionals and practitioners. That's been quite a long-running focus of ours, and I think it's been given a real injection at this event in terms of really wanting to not just genuflect towards the importance of the getting the research into forms and formats can really inform practice, how to organize the knowledge base of teachers and teaching, but to really take that very seriously indeed. And I that came through very strongly, and I think it's a very important theme that we probably, certainly at the OEC, I don't think we've driven hard enough yet. An issue that I think is important and came through in all sorts of ways is really the visibility, or rather the invisibility, of a lot of what goes on in teaching. A lot of teachers work in rather invisible ways, and perhaps quite a lot of those questions to do with autonomy, to do with trust, to do with respect, are about the questions around how to render teachers and teacher work more visible, but in ways that really do justice to the very strong professionalism and the very unique contribution that teachers make. How to make it more visible to other colleagues, how to make it more visible to the profession and to other people engaged in the educational world, and of course to the wider community. So I think that whole question around how to be less invisible, but in ways that really do justice, is something that, again, I think it's it goes often by the name of accountability, but I think perhaps we need to think of it, that one, through very strongly. And I do think that there's, around the whole question of the knowledge, the professional knowledge, and the professional learning, I was really impressed by Philippa's presentation this afternoon. I somehow feel that there's a basis for moving forward on questions of the nature of the professionals and the nature and the future. I was delighted to come back as the head of the now completed Schooling for Tomorrow project to think about the future explicitly. This event has invited us to do that, and to actually go back, to dust down, to blow the dust off some of those things we did before, and realize that perhaps we didn't do as much as we could have done then, but that it's not too late. And I was thinking about those scenarios of the future that I put up at the end. I'm not sure that's finished work. I think that's perhaps not finished work at all. And maybe there's a basis there for doing more work. And I can see that as part of that, I think we're going to have to take very seriously, and this is like I wear my current hat as head of the Innovative Learning Environments project and work at OECD. I think we're going to have to take very seriously the different locations, the different complex learning environments in which young people are learning, the hybrids, the networking, the non-formal learning, and so on. And how can we recognize that? How can we even make that a really important part of the educational work that's going on, while at the same time recognizing the key role of schools and the not losing a core sense of the professionalism and the expertise in teaching and learning that teachers have. So exactly how that might be taken forward through OECD or through another partnership, I'm not sure, but I do feel there is an agenda there to be developed. Thank you.
Can I now invite David Edwards to speak? David is currently, he's actually, you're riding two horses, aren't you?
Yes, in separate directions. No, together, same
day. He's the new Deputy General Secretary for Education International, and it's sort of, to a certain extent, he's my boss. And the second area is he's still at NEA as Associate Director for International Relations. So it takes a young person to do that sort of thing, I have to say. It's lovely to invite you now, David, to speak from EI and put the EI point of view. Thanks.
Thank you very much, John. So I'm going to do just like to talk about sort of five Gs, or the G5. First, I'm going to start with gratitude. I'm going to go global, go deeper, get connected, and get going. And this I'm going to speak about from the perspective of the teaching profession, which we at Education International take very seriously as one of our two legs of our identity, the other being a teacher union and taking care of those social justice issues that are very near and dear and very important as well. In terms of gratitude, I'd like to... we've already been thanking Cambridge and OECD and Open Society, and I want to thank many of you for coming and being part of this discussion, which I think very much is informing the conversation that's going to happen in the summit. So I want to thank you for that. I also think that I feel gratitude because although I am a teacher unionist right now, and will be forever probably, yes, I was first a teacher. I was a teacher for a number of years, and then I worked in a developing country working with teachers that worked with orphans. Then I was working for governments in the Americas for about 7 years, advising ministries of education on teacher policy, where I got to know a lot of what teacher unions were actually doing. And against the better advice and judgment of many of my colleagues who looked at me like, are you mad? I left the working with governments to take a job working with the teachers union. And let me tell you something. There is very little difference when you talk about bureaucracy, procedures, protocols, culture, positional politics, and all the rest when you look at between ministries and unions. And I actually think that it would do us good to have a little bit more border crossing. I was in Singapore recently talking to with Department of Education, a number of the folks from the summit, and had a conversation with a teacher there who was telling me that he was in the ministry for a period of time, then he was teaching, then he was going to be doing some research at the university, then he was going to be abroad actually studying probably, I think, Cambridge. I'm sure he didn't say the other one. And I was just thinking, wow, what an opportunity to have those multiple perspectives on the system of education, to be able to see what a university goes through in terms of how it thinks, to be able to look at a government in terms of trying to figure out how do you deal with these sort of political struggles and try to demonstrate to parents that kids are learning at acceptable rates and it doesn't matter where you send your kid, they're going to get a good education. And then obviously dealing every day with teacher unionists and leaders who I really firmly believe are both committed to the profession and are committed to the future of the planet and children and to greater social good. But I do think that this global part of it we need to push out on. I think that the summit provides a very important platform. I think the idea that you get the high-performing and the fast-improving countries to come to the summit is vital, but I think the comment was the vital few, but I would say the vital and still insufficient few. But there is a bit of replication going on. As a result of the summit, in the Americas, the OAS, my former organization, there is a meeting of ministers of education from Canada, Caribbean, Central America, all the way down to Latin America, the beginning of March in Suriname, where ministers will actually have a roundtable discussion with teacher unions, and I feel very, very happy about that. We know that there's a global partnership on education that used to be called the Fast Track Initiative for Education for All that for very long didn't have a seat at the table for teachers, but as a result of being able to demonstrate what it is we're about and what we're committed to doing, we got an invitation to be at a seat at the table with the private sector. Actually, I share a seat with Alicia Taylor back there. And with governments, developing country governments, donors, and others to have a really important conversation. One of the things we're doing there as EI is trying to work with our affiliates in developing countries to become part of local education groups that can express, articulate, do research, and have an impact on education policy in their countries. And also hold donors and governments accountable for what they say they're going to do. So we have a teacher union accountability matrix that we always talk about. I also think that the Teachers Task Force for Education for All at UNESCO is important to recognize. I think that UNESCO has just said that teachers and teaching and learning will be their new priority for their next 4-year plan. And the next global monitoring report is just as of yesterday, the letter went out from the director of the GMR, Pauline Rose. It says it's going to be about teaching and learning. I think that's very important. I think that the Global Campaign for Education is going to make the global teaching gap this year its main topic is another important sort of moment. So I think there are these important moments that are lining up globally. But I do think we need to go deeper. The question was raised, can teachers reimagine themselves? Can we reimagine ourselves? Yes, we can reimagine ourselves. We can assess ourselves. We invented assessment, and that's part of the thing that I actually talk about when I travel around the world and I'm with my fellow teachers, and I'm talking about professional knowledge. And I'm combining that professional knowledge with an ability to analyze situations where inequities are persistent and linking that back to the professional knowledge and the ability to say, what can we do about this situation? How can we figure out ways to individualize instruction? What do we need in terms of the resources, the inputs, the processes, the outputs? What do we demand? What do we want to see? And we need to be able to articulate that. And we need to go deeper. Right now, we have too many of our affiliates that are just struggling to stay afloat as unions. We have a union where I'm going to be going pretty soon, where its leader, because its members were out in the streets during the Arab Spring, was basically helicopter kidnapped from his bed and taken to prison, where he's still right now. A number of teachers who allowed their students to protest because they were a different Islamic group were tortured, actually had to watch their students be tortured and interrogated. We have countries where for many, many months, teachers go without any pay. And professional development, I can think about Liberia, where some of those, the idea of professional development is so exciting There's such a hunger for it, for good teacher education, for good development, but to put together a society, to have these statements. And so Education International also has a program called Quality Educators for All, where we will go into communities where you have paraprofessionals and contract teachers and help them gain a full qualification so that they not only can make a living wage, but that they also have the professional knowledge to be able to make a difference. We need to get connected. I think it's time for the networked learner leader to get moving. I spoke about a couple of different opportunities for that, and I'm going to say that in terms of the step forward. And I think we need to get going in a much more authentic and serious way, both for unions, for governments, for academia, for civil society, for parents, for citizens. I think it's time for us to stop cherry-picking the things that already tell us or prove what we already believe and start actually being open to have real discussions and real dialogues. And I think that one other thing I was going to say is just about the profession that we want. I don't believe we can fire our way to a professional teaching future that is meaningful and is going to attract people, the kinds of people, keep them there, get children excited. I don't think we can do that. But at the same time, I don't think it's as big of a problem if you look at where certain places are going in terms of counseling out right now. There's statements. I can think of about 5 unions off the top of my head that have already passed major resolutions talking about, you know, if you're doing harm for kids, then you don't deserve to be called a teacher. And we have ways to help you find other lines of work. That schools do not exist to give teachers jobs. We say that. We have a policy statement that lays that out that was just adopted unanimously at our Congress in Cape Town this summer, that about 2,500 teacher leaders from 170 countries adopted. So I think there is a serious conversation going forward. I think the fact that John and Gunters and others in our research department and our policy department have been able to make the inroads they have to be able to convince so many unions to come along with them and to, because there's a feeling on this side that if we go this way, I mean, we've heard the professional route before. Pinochet in Chile used to say, you know, you're not unionist, you should be professionals. Why don't you act like professionals? And so in some countries, the whole idea of professionalism has its sort of, you know, it rings back to a certain quiet, do what we tell you kind of thing. But we have to reclaim, as Mary said, what it means to be a professional, and we have to infuse that with the knowledge, and we have to carry that mantle forward. And for the future, I would like to propose, on behalf of Education International, a real, true global network for teaching excellence. I envision a partnership that can review, react, challenge, and extend on many of the ideas, the fads, the research, the experiences. I see it as a global hub. I see it as a place where a network of networks, where we already have the Inter-American Teacher Educator Network, and you have the Pan-African Teaching Council, and you have things in Europe, and you have things happening in APEC and elsewhere. But we don't know, what we haven't yet been able to do is link those all up in Commonwealth and else. We haven't been able to link them up in terms of preparation, in terms of evaluation, in terms of standards. Ron's here with the National Board of Professional Teaching Standards. They've been a partner with us in, okay, going forward with this idea. UNESCO is very much on board with this idea. That's part of the reason I think that they've made teaching their priority. The International Council for Education for Teaching is having a meeting in Accra, and I'm sending an invitation to any of you. It's in the beginning of July. I believe it's July 8th. We will be having a committee to launch this network. I have a number of other private sector, civil society, and other groups that are very much interested. I have World Teachers TV that has said they would like to come and figure out ways of doing professional development online. We know iEARN. But this is all right now English, and I actually want to extend this out so we don't just make this an Anglo exercise. We need to figure out a way to linking it up to other languages, what's happening in other regions, and we need to figure out ways of using technology to make that happen. But I want to thank you all for coming. This is a really important event. Education International is extremely committed to seeing this through. We're risking a lot of political capital, sometimes I like to say, in doing this. But we see this as hand in glove with our principal core values of education quality for all children, all people, everywhere as a human right. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. That's great. And I can recommend Border Crossing, as it happens. Right. And the last speaker is John Macbeth. I personally just want to thank him for all the support over the years. We had one working relationship. This last paper is, as someone has said, is almost a culmination, not a culmination, but a synthesis of an enormous amount of work that's been done over the last 20 years. And it's appropriate that John has the last word on behalf of Leadership for Learning. John.
Thanks, John. The good news is I'm not going to take 10 minutes. Morris recommended that I say that nobody's going to leave this room till the person owns up to to who wrote those things about me. You see, he's obviously been a teacher. He's obviously done that. Some brief reflections. I think one of the things about so many metaphors and images over the course of the day, but I love the one best about two horses going in different directions. I think that's a good one. My second reflection is about places for learning, and I think it has been so significant that we've had this here in the Muller Center. If you want to look at the criteria for people being able to talk, to exchange, to share professional development, good food, nice accommodation, etc., I think this is the paradigm. It's hard to beat, so thanks to the Muller Center, and particularly thanks to OSF, who made this Muller Center possible, because we couldn't have had it here without their support. The third point, if it's three, is about school self-evaluation. I would have to say that, but I think it's a real hallmark or first criteria of professionalism that organizations are able to speak for themselves, to have the rigor and the criteria to be able to embed self-evaluation in the daily life of schools. And when I first came in contact with OECD, I think it was the 1970s, where we had an opening conference in Lugano. This is well before you were born, I think, Tony, in the early 1970s. And what was invented then was education at a glance. And there were four networks. I don't know, do you remember network A, B, C, and D? Yes. Well, we were network D, and it was about public expectations of school. And we talked about indicators at that point, and there were the idea of three sorts of indicators were born. The first was indicators as hard measures, if you like. We didn't like that one so much. Indicators as dashboard lights, you know, the thing goes on in your car, a red light flicks, and you have no idea what it is, but you open the bonnet and you look in and you don't know what's going on. So you need to consult, you need to find somebody to help you. And the third one, which is the one we like most, is indicators as tin openers, that they just start the dialogue. They don't tell you a lot, but they initiate the dialogue, and data is for dialogue. And I think that's been a continuing theme in our work. The fourth or whatever number point it is, I want to come back to Philippa's reciprocal vulnerability. I love that notion because it is so contrary to the rhetoric about high reliability organizations. I've sat in seminars with David Reynolds and Sam Stringfield and Charles Tedley, who are very much pioneers of school effectiveness, and they've talked about talking to teachers saying you're not a high reliability organization, as an aircraft control tower, for example, has to be, and he says, as teachers, you are crashing jumbos every day. And if you're an HRO, there is a no risk, no failure. And that's just the total wrong paradigm, because I think the paradigm is reciprocal vulnerability. And in a Glasgow school a few years ago, I went in and this very new teacher in the school had on the wall, if at first you fail, try again, fail better. And you know, that was such, you know, that wasn't a high reliability organization, but it was people were able to talk about risk and talk about failure. My favorite anecdote, and I think I have to apologize to people who've heard it before, but it said so much about the whole issue of voice and student voice, which has been something in evaluation that's all has preoccupied me for decades, I guess. Many years ago, it must have been in the early 1980s, I was in a Chicago school, inner city school, elementary school in Chicago. And it was a fantastic school. It was one of those leading edge schools. It was a great place to be, wonderful culture that really did tune into student voice. And as I was leaving, going down the steps, this kid comes after me. He must have been about 11. And he said, Professor, before you leave, could I give you my business card? I said, oh, yes, thank you very much. And it was Kelvin J. Sammons, Dynatronics Limited. We supply all your hardware and software needs. And he had a website address, yes, even in the 80s. And he had a fax number, and he had where you could reach him, his address and all the rest of his company. And I went back into the school, and I said to the principal, God, that's incredible. You know, this kid's 10. And she said, yeah, we've got a few like that, you know. They know far more about ICT than their teachers do. And she said, you know what he did? He volunteered to do a two-day professional development sessions for our whole staff. He would take the whole staff for 2 days. I said, great. Did you take him up on the offer? No, it was too expensive. So I think that's when I got really interested in student voice particularly. Two things I would say in conclusion about the indicators for today. This is the first conference I've been at where there were no name tags left on the desk. You're going to find a couple of dozen of those. They're all gone, which means everybody who said they were coming was coming. And it's the first conference I've been at ever where Morris didn't fall asleep. And I think that is a wonderful testimony in your own words, Morris, to the quality of the contribution and the quality of the participation here. It's been absolutely, absolutely wonderful. It's certainly one of the best, if not the best, conference I've been at, and I'm really grateful to everyone who's been part of the organization and part of the participation. But I think we're going to do some more thanks, John, if I pass back to you.
Okay. Well, I just want to give John a clap anyway.